Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Ghouls in the House. I'm Natalie Latofsky.
And I'm Arnold Blumberg. And if you do hear anything in the background of this and possibly the next episode, just know that the world is on fire and we are not going to sit here without our air conditioning on.
We normally suffer for our art, but not today.
This episode is one that I had suggested a long time ago. We often try to do movies based on anniversaries, and we don't do as many episodes as we would often like to, so a lot of times we put together a list of anniversaries and then just watch them all slowly slide by, only to make a new list of anniversaries. So now we're looking at 50th anniversaries in 1974, which definitely isn't making me feel any older, and a favorite really creepy, weird, surreal movie that always gave me a strangely unsettling and yet pleasant feeling as a movie I liked seeing when I was a kid is Phase 4 from 1974, celebrating its 50th anniversary.
Think of their ability to evolve and adapt in ways that are so beautiful, but still so unknown. And all contained in one simple form.
They wanted us.
And I don't know why I've been drawn over the years to movies about ants of varying sizes, because ants creep me out. And having rewatched this with you, if I'd watched this movie brand new today, I would never have finished it.
Yeah, I mean, you get icked out when you see a commercial for like a pest control spray that even shows like one or two bugs on the screen. And yet you have an affinity for ant movies you saw as a child. And I mean, we've done an episode on them before, and that I can kind of understand, because those are not really like the ants you'd see, right? They're giant puppets.
Right.
Like, they're big ant puppets. But this movie uses actual footage of actual ants in it, like a lot of them.
And I have to say, I used to see this a lot when I was a kid. There were sequences in this movie that were starting to bother me a little bit, and I never used to have that feeling with this movie. I loved it. I don't know why, but also it hasn't changed my opinion of the movie. It's just that I never would have watched it with the way I feel today. So obviously I had more resistance to it then, or something about it clicked. And one day we'll have to fill in the gap between the giant puppets of them and the actual size ants shot with microphotography in Phase 4, and watch the Food of the Gods inspired 1970s movie Empire of the Ants with Robert Lansing and Joan Collins, because that features ants that grow to about 6 feet long.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a late era, if I remember right, Bird Eye Gordon movie with the ants just superimposed in really bad shots. But that one also really creeped me out as a kid, but I loved it. And they're like midway between the car size or like truck size ants of them and the real size ants of Phase 4.
It occurs to me we did both have childhood giant ant movies in a way, because for me it was Honey, I Shrunk the Kids
had ants, right?
Yeah. And the ants are good and like nice to the kids, and they feed them little bits of an oatmeal cream pie.
And the ants are good in Ant-Man too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, anyway, Phase 4, which is a movie that deserves a lot more attention than it often gets, because it is such a curiosity in a lot of the things that go into the making of it. It is, in fact, inspired by H.G. Wells' short story Empire of the Ants, at least partly. It was, in fact, the sole directorial effort of graphic designer Saul Bass, who's mainly known for his title sequences and his incredible design work, logos. And so there's a surreal, visually heavy tone poem kind of quality to this movie. It is not a very linear story.
It feels like an experience more than a story.
It's not really a story in the traditional sense. And all the things that I would normally point out as being flaws in another film, I think are strengths in this one.
Mm.
It's a weird sort of rumination on what happens when the natural world turns against us and decides it's had enough. And so it kind of fits well within a subgenre of films that include many others, some of which we've already talked about, including The Happening and other movies in which natural forces turn against us.
I also think it kind of fits in the same category of film as Messiah of Evil, where it's something that feels like there's an inevitability to everything that's happening, and also you're kind of just along for the ride as a viewer in an experience that feels like a natural motion. Like the whole experience of watching it kind of feels like being carried along like on the ocean, like you're floating.
This was a childhood film for me. It was one of the ones that you saw for the first time. It's also very claustrophobic because most of the movie, except for a couple scenes in the beginning, are entirely confined to one small research installation that is set up to investigate what appears to be the sudden and inexplicable change in behavior of ants in the Arizona desert, only for them to find out that the ants are way ahead of them and have plans that we will never truly understand, but apparently involve the future of all life on Earth and may include humans, but only in the sense that we will now be serving them. And most of the film is Michael Murphy, who mostly for bad these days, but I remember well from Woody Allen, Manhattan. Manhattan. But he's done a lot of stuff. And Nigel Davenport, British actor, who I had only just recently also seen when I decided to revisit something I hadn't seen in decades, the Jack Palance, Dan Curtis produced Dracula. He was Van Helsing in that same year. He did Van Helsing and then he played this part. And Lynn Frederick, who is a young woman who plays an even younger woman in this, whose entire career was destroyed when she became Peter Sellers' wife and she was blacklisted by Hollywood when everybody decided she was a gold digger. And that's a whole other story. But her life was destroyed.
I hate how many of those stories crop up in various ways for the films we watch from like the 50s to the 70s.
Yeah.
There's like a whole stretch where, I mean, I'm sure there's podcasts dedicated just to exploring that topic.
Right. But she's the daughter of a farming family that gets caught up in the sort of ant rising and is sheltered by the two scientists, old and young, as they investigate everything. And really the entire movie is them completely confounded by the ants as they try to figure out what's going on. And we're kind of all along for the ride.
It's also worth noting that the movie literally starts out by referencing like what's supposed to have been some sort of cosmic event that the whole Earth witnessed or something. There was like some kind of star or comet or weird nebula. Like, I couldn't quite follow where it started, but it like starts you there as if to say whatever's going on with these ants in Arizona came from space, maybe.
Kind of, sort of. But here's where I throw in the other bit. I never in my entire life had read this, and a while back, I think pre-pandemic, I think it was in one of the antique places we went to right before the pandemic. I found an old paperback copy of the novelization of Phase 4, which I didn't find a lot of information about, but I'm assuming may have also come from, I don't know if he invented the extra stuff in it or if it came from a draft of the script or what, but it was written by a very prominent sci-fi author, Barry Maltzberg, who I subsequently found more about, and I really want to share this with everybody too, and we get into it maybe later, but the book does fill in a few things, but only adds to the craziness and surreal quality of it. But the first chapter of the book does describe in very non-specific detail about some great cosmic war happening in space between various energies and an energy that's beamed here that decides to sit within the ants. And then occasionally throughout the rest of the book, right to the end of the book, are references to things like clear all channels and starting the next phase. And it really feels like the book wants you to feel more like there is a remote invasion taking place through the ants, and that some sort of cosmic consciousness is running things from a distant location. It doesn't make any more sense than the movie itself does.
Because the movie just kind of implies that something interesting happened in space and everybody was watching it and, ooh, it's blue and it's weird and it's cool. But then the implication is that perhaps whatever it was either, like, influenced the ants or awakened something, like, inherent or dormant in the ants that already existed.
Because we're told that ants that never used to cooperate, different species of ants, are all cooperating and all communicating. And it has great... It doesn't matter. None of this matters. Because it's all Bess and it's all visual, and all I remember is it has those incredible weird towers that the ants build that are so creepy. And it's like when you see something that apparently is created in the natural world that clearly is being designed with thought.
And geometry.
And the ants create everything with fine, finished surfaces, like all the other constructs they create later in the movie, where they reflect sunlight on their base to try to burn them out with heat. It's so disturbing to think the ants are building this stuff, and they are precision creating these things. And this movie is credited as potentially being the first place ever in history that invented the concept of crop circles, and may have inspired the guys that initially started the crop circle hoax in the UK just a year or two after this. So that's kind of interesting too.
I think what makes it particularly creepy and unsettling is the fact that geometry already is utilized and exists in the natural world. And if you watch any nature channel on TV for any period of time, you're bound to see some kind of special that involves seeing an intricate, perfectly symmetrical structure that an animal builds to make its nest, you know, and hives as well, when you think of bees, are very perfect inside. So there is already geometry in the natural world. And so it just takes something that exists a step further and has it look more man-made, look more finished. I mean, basically, the best way to describe these, and I think we talked about it while we were watching, that surely they must have been inspired by this movie, but the fifth element, when they have the each elemental, like, rock or that goes into the, like, temple slots, that's the same shape as these sort of ant monoliths that they're building.
Also, want to give a shout out to Ken Middleham. He's the wildlife photographer who had also shot microphotography of insects for a pseudo-documentary narrative called The Hellstrom Chronicle. I've never seen it, but a lot of people have talked about it being fascinating. And as a kid, I was always amazed by the yellow ants in this. One of the things that comes up in this movie is that the ants seem to be capable of adapting to the yellow the poison that they're using at one point to get rid of them, and they just absorb the yellow and become yellow ants. And I found out that there is a species of ant that's like glass, and you can get an ant to drink fluids or like eat stuff that has different colors, and it'll show through them. And those are real ants in the movie that I guess they gave them something that makes them yellow. And I always wondered, how the hell did they pull off making yellow ants in the movie? And it's like, you can, with real ants, apparently. And the stuff with real ants in this is astounding work, because it feels like the ants are acting sometimes. I love...
It genuinely does. Maybe that's one of the creepier things about
it. One of my favorite sequences is when the ants, they lose some ants in a particular attack that the scientists do to try to fight back against the ants. And we get this long sequence. It's the sequence that precedes them... the queen basically creating a new generation of ants with the yellow built in. Basically, they have this ability. They might die, but they will then learn from it and adapt in the next generation. And we get this long sequence of ants that are dying from the poison, dragging a body of one of them, dying, and the next one picking it up and dragging it, and basically dragging and dragging in turn until they get it to the queen so that she can absorb the yellow and start creating a new generation of poison-resistant ants. And it feels like the ants know what they're doing, and I don't know how he got them to do this stuff or how they do this stuff, but it's amazing work. And it also always reminds me of the bit from Godfather 2 where Michael says, you know, that he saw the guy blow himself up in the car. Right. And what does that tell you? That they can win. The idea that the ants are willing to die dragging this poisonous thing to her so that other ants will win. It's like they're going to win. You know pretty much from the beginning of the movie that the ants are going to win.
Which is also kind of the unsettling part about it. That the narrative structure that they've created for this movie, in a lot of films, you would just be with the human characters and yes. you'd be experiencing the things they experience as they happen and sort of seeing things through their eyes. But in this case, they're basically on the defensive the entire movie, and we as the viewers are being given a view of the ants' offense.
Yes.
Like, they are arguably on screen more in a sense than the people are, and it like feeds into, I think we'll sort of, when we get to the end of this, sort of, I think it does feed into the feeling of the ending, as if like the film has been constructed in order to show you the ant's perspective of what happened here.
Right. It's like they already won. They already run everything.
Yeah, like the movie's being made by the ants.
Here's the story of how this all happened and the new era of Earth that you are now a part of, human.
Yeah, and, like yes. it's an orientation video.
Yeah, and the thing is, we'll talk more about it later, but there's like an entire extended 4-minute ending that was long known to exist and has recently been restored and put back in.
Man, is that trippy.
That we didn't watch. I showed you like a brief bit of it, but it's like Saul Bass like blowing out the doors and going, this is what I really want to do with it. And it's weird, weird symbolic stuff that suggests a sort of post-apocalyptic era in which the humans are now slaves to the ants. But you get a bit of that at the end of this, it seems. You also mentioned at one point there's really like Night of Living Dead with ants,
because it's siege got the
siege. It's a siege movie. It's claustrophobic. We're in, when we're not with the ants, we're inside the geodesic dome that they created as part of their little base. And you also mentioned one point that Nigel Davenport's character of, what is it, Hubs?
Yeah,
Dr. Hubs, is very much like Quint in Jaws. From the beginning, he seems obsessed with trying to win. Like, he's supposed to be there to investigate a phenomenon, but his attitude is very much about winning. And the thing is, I will say one thing that I never thought of when I was a kid, which is I think it does the movie a disservice to have his character so obviously crazy from the beginning. In the same way that I've often criticized The Shining, which I think has things about it that are wonderful, the Kubrick movie, but also things I think are wildly overpraised. I think Jack Nicholson's performance in The Shining, while great in its own way, is also one of the biggest problems in the movie, because he's supposed to be a guy that's driven crazy by the ghosts in the hotel, but he's clearly crazy from the moment we meet him.
Like, it would work better,
you know,
if he were just regular average dad
guy. Which he can't do. Like, there's always the scene where they're driving there. They haven't gotten there yet. And he's like, he saw it on the television. And he's like, he's already at 11. So there's like no place to go.
Right.
Same thing with this.
Well, they go to like 24 is right. what they do.
The same thing here. Is that Nigel Davenport's performance, he's a lunatic. And it feels a shame that we're not getting a more sober response to the ants to see the defeat of humanity through the ants. It almost feels like the movie is setting us up for that by just saying, look, he's crazy already anyway. We know they're going to lose. And Michael Murphy's character is like the young hotshot scientist. He's not capable of handling this on his own. It's also bizarre that an event that, as it turns out, seems to be seismic and global in its intent and in its effect is basically coming down to two guys in a dome with a teenage girl. And are they the only ones working on this anywhere on the planet?
Because I guess it's like this is almost, and again, you mentioned The Happening before. It's sort of like that also feels pulled from the history of movies like this, where whatever this phenomenon is starts in one location and then spreads out from there, right? So in The Happening, it's Central Park, and then it spreads out from Central Park. And so here it's like, well, they're starting this in the desert. They're going to sort of perfect their technique here and figure out how to make it go global. I guess my perspective on our like crazy doctor coming into this is that on the one hand, he's shown as being, I think, maybe more of like a fanatic than crazy. He's like so singularly focused on these ants, and so
he has no empathy,
right? I mean, you could read that as like eccentric, overly focused scientist. You could also, after then seeing how things go later in the movie, interpret it as maybe there's something the ants have done to like adjust his pheromones or like change his focus.
Well,
or
certainly once he's bitten.
Oh yeah, it's over. He's
definitely dying from whatever the hell they put
in. Yeah, once he's bitten, now we're in Dawn of the Dead territory. And yeah, he's like Roger slowly like changing color against the wall.
And hiding his arm that's like grown to three sizes.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a lot rolled into this. Like, basically any siege movie, like, you could compare it to a lot of Westerns, that kind of siege movie.
Yeah, sure.
You could compare it to something like The Thing, where it's sort of got the science plus the siege plus the possibly alien force affecting things in the natural world around you. Definitely got a Jaws vibe to it. It's odd. It's a very odd film, and it's also difficult to describe in terms of plot, because there's not a lot of story. Like, we've basically told you the whole story, which is ants are doing something odd. Scientist goes to study ants. Scientist brings in another scientist that he knows has a different discipline from him, right? He's the ant guy, and he brings somebody who studies patterns and waves and, like, has had some luck communicating with other, like, animals.
Whales.
Yeah, via interpreting their speech patterns. So he wants to bring in somebody to help him talk to the ants, basically, because that's kind of the last step. And a teenage, I put in air quotes because it's the classic, like, cast someone who does not look like a teenager to play a teenager.
She was older, but she's supposed to be 16. Yeah.
And her farm family gets killed by the ants and or the ant repellent, depending on the family member.
Right.
And she manages to survive and ends up in the, like, geodesic dome with them. And then the rest of the movie is just basically the ants trying to smoke them out of their little dome and them trying to figure out how to get a message out about the ants. That's where I got the Quint feel, because he doesn't want him to end this experiment, and he, like, destroys the communication.
Well, the ants do.
Or
the ants do, but he's okay with it.
Yeah.
Because it's like,
he probably would have if the ants didn't.
But the ants apparently did. That's another thing. They constantly are sacrificing themselves by literally throwing their bodies at a problem.
Mm-hmm.
They will burn out the communications. They destroy the truck. The idea of an army of thousands upon thousands of creatures that are willing to die in the thousands to win is so disturbing.
The birds, that was the other.
The birds is a good one too. Yeah,
yeah,
absolutely.
The other kind of feeling of it, of
absolutely,
like, suddenly nature. And she even says in The Birds that there are birds of all different species
talking to each other.
Talking to each other.
And the expert says, well, that can't happen. They don't do that. Well, now they do. I also want to give another shout out to Brian Gascoigne, who handles the music. It's one of the reasons as a kid I love this too, is it just has such a oppressively creepy feel with some wonderful musical passages in this, especially at the end.
Thank you.
there's a sound to this movie that's one of the reasons I used to leave it on. It's depressing. It's a very depressing movie.
Yeah, this is not what I would call comfort food of a film.
And yet it used to be sometimes. Yeah. I would put this on and I liked having it on. I also wanted to mention, too, going back to the book.
Mm.
So, Lynn Frederick's character, they rescue the girl. And one of the things that, in revisiting the movie, I thought was so refreshing and so, like, I relieved to see, is that Michael Murphy's character is a younger man. He, like, kind of is like, you doing okay, you know, get you some food, whatever. We never really see him in the movie at any point show any interest in her sexually, except I think there's a shot in the movie when they first see her at the farm and she's riding the horse. He looks at her like, oh, there's a cute girl riding a horse, but he doesn't know who she is yet. He doesn't know how old she is yet. And then once they have her at the base,
he's very paternal.
He's very paternal. He takes care of her. He knows she's lost her family. And
he also knows the other doctor is crazy and has no empathy.
Yeah. And he never shows any interest in her other than he wants to take care of her and get her out of there, actually. Get, like, authorities to come and pick her up and save her. The book is different.
I haven't read the book, but I have been told about the book.
The book, once again, by author Barry Ann Malzberg, is filled from almost the very beginning with some of the most, like, over-the-top sexual, like, imagery and misogyny that felt like right away it should be in, like, their Men Writing Women Reddit or, like, you know. There's descriptions of inanimate objects that refer to women's anatomy. And the character that Michael Murphy plays in the movie is depicted in the book, because we get his internal thoughts,
mm-hmm.
as constantly battling his intense desire to have sex with her, but he knows it's wrong, but oh, he can't stop thinking about it. And oh, what would he do? And it's just, it's relentless. And
a parade of gross.
And they keep dehumanizing her by referring to her as things like a mouse, or just, there's all kind of stuff. There's even stuff that I think I was originally going to talk about that I don't even remember anymore. I took some notes and really, screw it. Because Malzberg is obviously a creep. And the idea of taking something that wasn't even there and deciding, you know what Phase 4 needs? It needs more really creepy sex stuff about the teenage girl. That's what the book needs. And then I looked him up and found out that he was a legend in the science fiction community, a contributor to the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America Bulletin, someone with his partner Mike Resnick, who are considered icons of the science fiction community, and then finally accused of multiple issues related to sexism, including the fact that they wrote some kind of op-ed or something about the problems with lady editors and lady writers, and that, you know, when they're beauty pageant beautiful or a knockout, they're okay, but when they're not, it's like, oh, as long as they're pretty, and all kind of other stuff that I didn't even bother delving into. But in other words, he's garbage, and it's fascinating that the Phase 4 book is almost, at times, typical novelization of lifting dialogue from the script and probably written from a draft.
Right.
But he really worked hard to add a lot of character into it, all of which is disgusting. And apart from that, the only other thing that he may or may not have added, or it may have been in the script but then not realized in the film, is that at the beginning and end, we get the parts that I told you about earlier, where it kind of implies that there is a remote alien intelligence that may be running this.
Right.
And that's it. And the reading the book was a very, very unpleasant but somehow fascinating experience too, because I learned about someone I'd never even heard of before that I now know is trash. So there's that. And it's also interesting to me that the movie ends in a similar way to Star Trek the Motion Picture, where the idea is there is a future of some kind of new era of humanity, and it involves a pair that has been selected by a higher power to presumably procreate. And
yeah, that part's a little unclear and a bit creepy.
And it is him, it is Michael Murphy's character, and the girl I say the girl, like in all these movies, the girl who is in fact Kendra, and Michael Murphy's character who is Lesko. And it is Lesko and Kendra who are chosen to be together, but he didn't seem to have any interest before that.
It's also unclear exactly what they want, because it's sort of worth noting that throughout the film, we get like little text cards on screen where it'll tell us what phase we're in.
Right. That, I, by the way, as a kid, that was one of the things I always found particularly creepy, because you knew the movie was called Phase 4.
Right.
And when you saw the thing coming up, there was like this really unsettling anxiety level to it of like, what's Phase 4 going to be? When are we getting to Phase 4?
It's like watching an episode of Hot Ones where they have like the second hot sauce and they're like crying and they're like, wait, if this is number two, like what happens when we get to the end?
Right.
And it's like you get to sort of, as it escalates, you think like,
right,
where is this going? And ultimately, maybe one of like the weirder or creepier things about it is ultimately we don't get to know what Phase 4 is.
Right.
Like Phase 4 is what signifies the end of the movie.
Spoiler alert.
Well,
we already
I mean,
did that.
This no, is no, no. our podcast.
I know.
So you listen, you know.
It's... The end of the movie involves him, Lesko, and Kendra being left alive. Hubs dies. And Kendra, that's right. Kendra goes out to sacrifice herself, thinking that she's a bad person because of having attacked the ants earlier and that they're holding it against her. And then it turns out they already have her somewhere. And when Lesko goes to find her, the two of them are reunited in this underground, like, sand cavern the ants have. And then we get the movie goes crazy for, like, 30 seconds, except that in that extended ending, it would be, like, 4 minutes and 30 seconds.
You say goes crazy. It goes crazier.
The movie just ends. And, you know, with a lot of movies that would just end that way, I would be mad at them. I was never mad at this movie for that ending. I was disturbed by it, unsettled. I found it really skin-crawlingly creepy, but I also liked it.
Mm-hmm.
And as you were pointing out the phases, it's at the end, when the credits are going to roll, that Phase 4 turns up. So in other words, whatever's about to happen, which involves the ants having selected the two of them for whatever, is going to be Phase 4, which, by the way, is also different in the book. For some reason, I don't understand. Maybe he was too busy thinking about the next weird thing he was going to write about Kendra. But he moves Phase 4 earlier in the book and actually makes Phase 5 the ending, which doesn't make any sense at all.
The movie's called Phase 4.
The movie's called Phase 4, Barry. Eye on the ball here. But he's busy thinking of other things.
I mean, and also, I think it's easy, just from a cultural perspective, to assume, oh, the two of them have been chosen to pair up, right? It's that like Adam and Eve mentality.
Yeah.
But also, I don't know that that's necessarily the case. Like, he's important because he's a communicator. That's literally what he does. He is somebody who has figured out how to communicate between species. And so he is like an essential translator for them. And then she is somebody who seems just very, like, earnest and innocent. And, like, you can tell that she is being genuine with you. And maybe it's just that they need also her as someone that people will understand is not lying and is, like, telling them exactly what's happening. That maybe it's really just about communication. Because that's ultimately what the ants have been doing the entire time. Including building the towers, like including sending messages, like essentially coded in geometric shapes that they could then print out on their little dot matrix there.
Right.
Just like churning it out on a roll. And that in and of itself is also a fascinating concept for them to communicate using mathematical geometry.
Because he repeats
words.
one of the favorite sci-fi tropes that like math is the universal language, like we would always be able to communicate math, which I've always found to be a bit flawed as a concept, but okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little, math is too precise, I think,
but
all language.
It works, yeah. I mean, it works for telling the story. It's an interesting way of looking at it, too. Like, they're picking two people that representing a channel of communication with the humans, basically.
Yeah, that maybe they selected that specific location because that was near her, and it could then pull in the other guy that, like, that all of this was inevitable, right? It was just, this was always going to happen, and it was happening, and it is happening all at the same time. Which also kind of reminds me of, and now I am blanking on the name and you're going to be able to tell me, there's a zombie movie that we covered at one point where it essentially loops itself, where like the zombies come off of a plane.
Nightmare City.
It's like, it's that kind of feeling of like you get through this whole film and then realize like there was never any stopping this. Like them trying to stop it was basically the test to make sure they were the right people to choose.
I'm fascinated by, the older I'm getting, looking back at things I loved as a kid. And I'm sure people, like, we all go through the same thing. We think we invent it, but obviously everybody goes through the same thing. And it's like, now I'm like settling into my early 50s. I'm feeling more and more every day how different that is. At times I think about it a lot. How different it feels. And yet I feel sometimes like I'm still me and I don't understand how all that time has gone by. But then I think also about myself younger, and it feels like a different person. And one of the things that strikes me is when we do things like this, and if I haven't enjoyed something or seen something consistently over the course of my life, but maybe haven't revisited something in a while, and see it in a new way. First of all, one thing I've been dealing with, which you know very well, is sometimes revisiting a lot of stuff from my childhood, I'm discovering how deeply problematic and awful it was on a level that I never recognized as a kid, because I just wasn't aware of those things, for bad mostly, but for good and bad. But then also, there's other stuff that's not about that, like about it being socially wrong or morally wrong, but just different. And one of the things I've noticed is I used to love and talk about loving movies where there was no hope. I used to talk about that a lot. Even like as I got older, which feels like not that long ago, when I used to be really steeped in zombie stuff, I used to talk about how, to me, the best way these stories work is if the movie starts and you know there's no hope. I can't even wrap my head around why I thought that was something I liked. But it was...
I kind of can, actually.
But it's like now, it's like all I want is hope. But Phase 4 I used to love, because when I'd sit down and I'd catch it at the beginning particularly, I'd think, this is awesome because this is going nowhere good. And I always thought, this is just ending horribly. And zombie movies where everybody's going to die at the end, I used to love that stuff.
Well, here's the thing. Even now, there have been times when we've watched a movie, and there's one I can think of in particular, which I won't mention because I don't want to spoil it. It's rather recent. Okay. But it involved two characters where it was unclear what was going to happen to them. Will they make it? Will they not make it?
Oh, okay. I know what you're talking about.
And
right.
We get, you know, to like the third act of the movie, and suddenly it's clear they do make it, and like then the story is still going from there.
Yeah.
And you basically told me that was when you could start enjoying the movie, because the whole time you're watching it and
I
you
was
get
tense
this
the whole time watching it was terrible.
You get this anxiety of like not wanting to like a character and then have them like not be there in the end.
Are you saying that I used to like the apocalyptic stuff because
there's no anxiety.
I knew where it was going.
You know exactly where it's going.
But I never used to be as anxious as I am now.
You weren't aware that you were as anxious as you are now, maybe. But all of us are anxious.
So what you're saying is, this is like therapy while we're recording, folks. So I don't even care about you guys anymore. If you want to listen to this, that's fine. Turn it off, fine. I'm busy getting this therapy, so this is what's important.
I'm not licensed in any way for this.
This is still working. So... So you're saying that when I used to like that stuff, it was because the certainty of a bad ending was still a certainty, and therefore it was comforting because I didn't have to worry about where it was going.
Exactly.
I have never, ever thought of that.
You're the one who told me you would constantly seek out to try to find out everything about a movie, and you still do a lot of the time before you watch it, where yes. like you were going to read a whole script. You want to know
the ending. I read entire scripts of Star Trek movies before they came out.
It's just another offshoot of that, of like you just need to know where it's going so that you can enjoy the journey.
That's, I never thought about it that way. That makes total sense, but it never occurred to me.
And you still feel that way, but now you in particular would like it to go someplace nice.
Yes.
Okay. Like you want to know it's going someplace that has some hope, and then you can also enjoy watching it and see what happens. So before it was sort of like it was okay either way as long as you knew. Now you kind of want it to go skew more towards hope, and that's sweet.
That's really amazing. This is the most profound episode of Ghouls in the House ever.
And it's about ants.
And it's about ants. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. I never thought about it that way. I can still enjoy a lot of the ones like this. I enjoyed seeing this again, but I also wouldn't watch this nearly as often as I used to.
Right.
I mean, I would have watched this a lot. Like, not a lot, but I mean, yeah, every few months if it popped up on a channel or whatever, I'd watch it again.
Yeah.
But I'm not that interested. And also, like I said, I also have a sensitivity to the ant footage now that I never used to have. And it's definitely intensified a bit because there were sequences that I actually felt I almost couldn't handle it. And I still managed to get through it. But I think
we're much more likely to put on them than we are Phase 4.
All them I can watch over and over again forever. But yeah, but and zombie stuff too. I can, like Night of the Living Dead, for instance, I can watch that anytime practically.
Right.
And have that on all the way through. And talk about downer of an ending. But also I'm used to it. So that's okay. But if I'm seeking out other things now, I definitely want it to be hope oriented rather than no hope oriented. Even if it's a zombie story. And like the zombie person I used to be, used to do all the documentaries and lectures and everything, always talk about like this genre works best when there's no hope. And now I just think, nah, let's have some hope in a zombie story.
It's actually, I think, one of the reasons both of us enjoy putting on Scout's Guide to the Zombie Apocalypse.
Yeah, it has a nice ending.
It's just, it's a movie that's oddly sweet for like a movie about a whole bunch of teenage boys facing down a really weird zombie apocalypse.
Did we do Scout's Guide in an episode of this?
I don't think so, and no. I won't say much. I think we should get there at some point.
We're going to have to do Scout's Guide. Anyway, Phase 4, which is what we're talking about. I've just learned something about myself that I never knew before, so there's that. I do ultimately think that Phase 4 is a fascinating bit of early 70s science fiction. There is a It fits very neatly, too, within the era, a sort of both pre, mid, and post-Watergate, also definitely end of Vietnam era, 70s cinema. I still maintain that some of the darkest, some of the most depressing, but also some of the most profound and meaningful storytelling in movies happened in the early 70s before everybody started locking society down again and not letting people say things. You know, particularly get to the Reagan era, basically. Like, everything we talk about other aspects of society, it happened in movies, too. And for a brief window, from the late 60s into, say, the mid to late 70s, it felt like movies were becoming this thing where you could talk about everything.
It was catharsis.
And say profound things. And, like, you know, Soylent Green and so all everything you could think of. And then all of a sudden, not that there aren't good examples, but as a concentrated era, it was a peak that I don't think we've ever achieved again.
The 80s are a real record scratch after that.
Yes, really. And also in terms of just even visually, put any 70s like movie from like 72, 74, put that on screen side by side with a movie from like 82, 84, and it looks horribly ugly in comparison to the 70s movie, which has the texture and grain of good 70s film. And there's just no comparison. And Phase 4 fits with things like Soylent Green and Silent Running and even Logan's Run a little later, like movies that are far more cynical about things, but also willing to say profound things about it. And Phase 4 is ultimately hard to figure out what it's saying, except that it's saying on a certain level, I feel it's basically saying humanity is terrible. and maybe the ants have the right to take a shot at things now.
Well, it's also saying that humans always center themselves in the story. And this is sort of saying, what if you took a step back and considered the way things look and the way things are from the non-human point of view, which in this case is the ants, and to say, look, they outnumber us. Like, there are more of them here. Arguably, they were probably here first. In fact, I say arguably, but you look at evolution, they were here first.
They found ants in amber.
Yeah. And so...
they haven't changed in an evolutionary sense, yeah.
Yeah, so it sort of becomes sense of, like, the humans keep acting like the ants are attacking them. Except all of this started because, one of the humans went out and just used, like, incendiary devices to blow up all the ants' towers.
We did forget to mention that, really, it doesn't escalate until Hubs himself attacks them.
He gets mad because the ants aren't doing anything interesting.
That he wants them to do, right.
Right. So he blows them up and starts everything in motion. So all this starts because the humans basically go, hey, and then knock down all their houses with fire. Not a great start to a relationship. And basically just becomes almost this self-absorbed tale of the humans thinking they're much more important than the ants. And therefore they have more of a right to live and more of a right to exist, and this is their space that the ants have invaded, when really it's vice versa.
By the way, that's another point too, is that it's also, I never thought of it quite this way, but it's also a great, like, metaphorical statement on colonialism in general, and the way humans, like white men, but humans just in general, treat everything, because we were introduced to that community that was being built near where the ants started, and that's when, like, the ants invaded, destroyed some of the houses,
right,
and they had to clear out the place. And I'm thinking, yeah, but that's, you're acting as if you were entitled to build your community there. Meanwhile, this is what we do. We invade places, destroy indigenous populations, ruin ecology. It's like, no one said you had a right to build your community there. You just decided this is where you're going to be. And it's almost like Phase 4 is just like a feature length version of the ants saying, it's not always about you.
Yeah. And so I think it kind of has that same 70s feeling that you can get from films like Living Dead at the Manchester Morgue.
Oh, that's
or cool. Even Jean Rollin's Grapes of Death.
Oh, yeah. I haven't seen that in forever.
I mean, that's not as recommended a movie as Living Dead at the Manchester Morgue. It's an odd one.
Also has one hell of a poetic final shot, too.
But yeah, I mean, all of these films that are essentially centered around this ecological message and this focus on, like, what are we doing to this planet? Whose planet is it anyway? And, like, these themes certainly carry through, and you can watch them in a modern sense and feel it very strongly as well. But also, I don't know I'd want to watch it again. Like, it's worth having seen, and it's interesting, and it's an experience, but also it felt, like, interminable. Like, because there's no real story, it's just something gets kicked off, and then you're just watching it happen. It's sort of just like watching a snowball roll down a hill. So you kind of...
an anthill.
Oh, an anthill. It's like watching a sand ball rolled down an anthill. I don't really know how this works, but it feels just sort of like you're watching something that was put into motion that cannot be changed and is just on this set rigid course of where it's going. And so it's interesting, and it's atmospheric, and it's creepy, and just all around odd and very 70s, and yet also probably not that revisitable.
Thanks for listening to Ghouls in the House, featuring Natalie Bielatowski and Arnold T. Blumberg. You can find Natalie on Threads at Positively Natalie and me at Doctor the Dead. Our movie this episode was Phase 4, 1974.
Perfect altruism and self-sacrifice.
Ghouls in the House is an ATV Publishing production. Check out our other podcasts, books on your favorite fictional worlds, and other assorted goodies at www.atvpublishing.com.
We knew then we were being changed and made part of their world. We didn't know for what purpose, but we knew we would be told.